Good morning once again. My name is Bob Funk. We are going to move into the Max Blumenthal's testimony to the Russell Tribunal on Palestine concerning recent Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip. Stay with us while we enjoy Max Blumenthal on the Russell Tribunal.
It's an honor to be here, especially with two fellow members of the 2013 Simon Wiesenthal Center's anti-Israel, anti-Semite list, Richard Falk and Roger Waters. I was number 9, tied with Alice Walker, and Richard and Roger beat me. We have stiff competition. Ayatollah Khomeini was number 1, so we're going to try the best we can. I regret that number 8 couldn't be here, European sports venues. I want to, before I start, just acknowledge two people who made the testimony I'm going to present possible. The first is Dan Cohen, who's here in the front row all the way from Phoenix, Arizona, who was with me in the Gaza Strip and who stayed on to cover some of the most intense bombing towards the end, filming all of the testimony. We will release all of the footage in the future. And Ibah Rezek, the researcher and translator from Gaza City, my colleague who I wish could be here. The atrocities that we documented formed an undeniable pattern, suggesting that the crimes committed by Israeli forces in Gaza during Operation Protective Edge were the product of stated military policies, or at least rules of engagement, that enabled massacres, summary executions, wholesale residential destruction, the use of civilians as human shields, and abductions. I'm going to describe these atrocities in as much detail as possible. I hope that after a full day of descriptions of atrocities, they're not superfluous. And I'll allow the members of the jury to judge for themselves these crimes in the context of the question of genocide. In the rubble of destroyed homes surrounding a dusty field lined with ruins in Shujaiya, Dan Cohen and I found a laminated map which had been left by Israeli soldiers in an ammunition box. And this map should now magically appear behind me, according to plan. I don't know if we're executing our... here it is. This is the first time that this map has been publicly displayed. I'd actually been concerned about displaying it publicly before, but now, in light of the news that Iran delivered to us, I feel liberated somewhat, or at least reckless. And I analyzed this map with assistance from Iran, who, as you know, is a combat veteran and is capable of understanding not only the Hebrew, but the military jargon. The map was produced by an Israeli company, but if you look closely, it's dated with American dating, raising the question of whether the mapping was done in coordination with the NSA. 7/17/2014, if it were Israeli, it would be 17/7/2014, so that's an interesting clue. The map, in my opinion, indicates a clear policy to transform areas of Shujaiya into free fire zones where civilians could be killed simply for being present. In orange, in the upper center of the map, here, is the phrase Tsir Hasuf, or we cleared it out. That pertains to this road, which was used for jeeps and tanks and so forth. And all the houses here were completely destroyed. In fact, nearly all of this area was completely destroyed. This is the buffer zone. And Israel destroyed all this in order to tighten the cage on the residents of the Gaza Strip. Gaza City is this direction. In the upper right-hand corner, inscribed in red Hebrew letters, is the phrase Hardufim. Right? And this is a code that's invoked over army radios to indicate when soldiers are killed in combat. The killed soldiers are referred to as Hardufim. According to Iran, the phrase was used during Operation Cast Lead to delineate the areas where Palestinian civilians could be killed. So it has this double usage. It appears that this line was drawn After the Golani Brigade, which had invaded Shuja'iya, lost 13 soldiers during the clashes that occurred on the evening of July 19th, when the phrase Hardufim echoed across Israeli army radios. This occurred hours before the Israeli soldiers occupied homes in Shuja'iya the next morning. So the labeling suggests that the revenge line that Iran described today was not necessarily imaginary or drawn up according to the whim of individual soldiers, but was actually delineated. My colleague, Mohammed Abdullah, took me to the area where Salem Shamali was executed on camera, the film you witnessed. And it occurred right around here behind the Hardufim line. This line could have been the revenge line. At the eastern end of the central area, marked in orange Hebrew letters, a soccer field. These are actually black letters. I met Mohammed Fatih Al-Arir. His home was a virtual cave furnished with a single sofa. In his backyard, four of his brothers were executed in cold blood. One of them, Hassan Al-Arir, was mentally disabled and had little idea he was about to be killed. Mohammed Al-Arir told me he found bullet casings next to the heads of the victims when he discovered their decomposing bodies. Just next door to his home, and I regret not bringing photographs, but these photographs are available online and I've storified them all of these homes and the sites of the killings, was the Shamali family. Their home was, and they are of course one of the hardest hit families in Shuja'iya. Hisham Nasser Shamali, 25 years old, described to me what happened when five members of his family decided to stay in their home to guard the thousands of dollars worth of clothing stocks that they planned to sell through the family business. When soldiers approached the home with weapons drawn, Shamali said his father emerged from the home with his hands up and attempted to address the soldiers in Hebrew. Pay attention to this detail because it will form a pattern. He couldn't even finish the sentence before they shot him, Shamali told me. His father miraculously survived after being left for dead for 3 days. In Khuza, just east of Khan Yunis, where the worst massacres occurred, multiple witnesses described to me soldiers gathering locals in the center of town as they occupied the area on July 23rd, then asking if anyone spoke Hebrew. When a 55-year-old man who hasn't been identified to me but who was described to me by multiple witnesses stepped forward to answer in the affirmative that he spoke Hebrew, they shot him in the heart in front of everyone assembled. In Rafah, on the outskirts of Rafah, in the eastern section, near the buffer zone where the destroyed Yasser Arafat International Airport lays, I met the Abu Sa'id family. 19-year-old Mahmoud Abu Sa'id told me that when Israeli soldiers arrived at his family's home, they also inquired if anyone spoke Hebrew. When his father, Abdul Hadi Abu Sa'id, answered in the affirmative, they shot him in the chest as well. And he too was a miraculous survivor. Please tell me when I have 15 minutes left. So, a clear pattern has been established, though the army's motives here in shooting men, men who had probably worked in Israel at some point before the siege, shooting men who spoke Hebrew, their motives had not been established. And so it was with the executions of the Shamali family and their neighbors, the Al-Arir. And so it was in Rafah with the soldiers who occupied the Abu Sa'id family's home, who shot Salah Israbi and Ala Abu Shabab, two young men who had attempted to flee under the intensifying Israeli shelling, sniping them to death from across the street on July 26th. According to Israbi's father, Suleiman, his 22-year-old son was shot to death while attempting to rescue Abu Shabab, whom he found bleeding in the street. Every time I have a son, they kill him. Every time I have a business, they bomb it. Every time I plant crops, they burn it. Those were the words of Suleiman Israbi, a victim of continuous ongoing violence. This didn't all occur in a vacuum. In Huzza, locals described to me witnessing hundreds of casualties as Israeli soldiers attacked those fleeing the town during the six-day siege. Among them was Adir Rojela, a 16-year-old epileptic girl blown out of her wheelchair by a tank shell as she fell behind her family fleeing on the road leading out of town. Hani Najjar of Huzza escaped only to find six corpses in his home, five in his bathroom and one in his kitchen. When he returned, they had been handcuffed, had their throats slit with the knives he used to slaughter his chickens, riddled with bullets, then set alight with grenades. The bathroom was covered in dried blood and pieces of flesh when I visited. And according to journalist Jesse Rosenfeld, who interviewed fighters from Islamic Jihad who participated in the clashes in Huzza, some of these men were fighters associated with Islamic Jihad. Their execution while held captive and defenseless is no less a war crime than if they were civilians. This is a violation of international law. I should tell you that Dan Cohen and I did find weapons in a school in Huzza. It was a school for girls, for young women in the center of town. We went into the principal's office and we found a M72 Law anti-tank weapon left by Israeli soldiers who had vandalized the school with Stars of David. Israel purchased 26,000 of these weapons from the United States, and they're manufactured in Dan's hometown, good old Phoenix, Arizona. Dan and I met two International Red Cross volunteers from Gaza who worked with ambulance crews throughout the war, and we're going to release video of these interviews. They were called entering Huzza during the siege to collect the body of Mohammed Abadla, a local man who had been tied to a tree by both arms and riddled with bullets by Israeli soldiers. When they arrived at the site of the execution, a group of Israeli soldiers ordered one of the volunteer's colleagues to exit his ambulance, told him to walk 5 meters forward, then to hold up his cigarette lighter. When he did so, they shot him in the heart and leg, killing him in front of his colleagues. These volunteers told us they later found a man in Huzza with rigor mortis, holding both hands over his head in surrender, his body filled with bullets. They then discovered a family, men, women, and children, one of the 89 families completely liquidated by Israeli forces during Operation Protective Edge, 89 families, so badly decomposed they had to bury them with a bulldozer in a mass grave, conjuring images of some of the darkest times in European history. The vast majority of bullet wounds they found in the victims they retrieved were to the head and the chest, shoot to kill. In Beit Hanun, I visited the home of the Wahadan family, who you heard about from Ivan, who had been prevented from leaving their home. And it's important to recognize that Beit Hanun was one of the areas that was leafleted. And so the residents were told to leave, but this family was kept in their home, at least seven members. Israeli forces knew they were there and called in an airstrike on the home. Seven members were killed, including two-year-old Rena Wahadan. Were they used as human shields? That's an open and very valid question. But in other areas, I was able to document cases in which the use of human shields by Israeli soldiers was undeniable. And the New York Times has not looked into these. On the outskirts of Rafah, soldiers, where I met the Abu Sa'id family, I heard testimony from 19-year-old Mahmoud Abu Sa'id of how Israeli soldiers stripped him, stood him in front of windows in his own home, and used him as a human shield while they sniped at his neighbors, killing the two men I described before, attacking him with their dogs during intermissions. In Huzza, members of the Najjar family told me how soldiers forced him to stand at opposite corners of their roof for a full day while the soldiers sniped at their neighbors attempting to evacuate. In the northern village of Umm al-Nasr, members of the Mismeh, Madhun and Jarad family told me that they were forced to sit in the center of town for 3 hours between 6:30 a.m. and 9:30 a.m. on July 18th, 100 meters in front of Israeli tanks or less, presumably to protect the Israeli tanks. In most cases, those used as human shields In many cases, those used as human shields were then abducted and taken to prisons inside Israel for weeks of harsh interrogation, something you've heard about today. Afif Charad, 32 years old, and his 26-year-old brother, Ahmad, were abducted after being used as human shields in Umm al-Nasr and were held for 8 and 16 days, respectively, in a prison in Ashkelon. They were beaten all along the way by soldiers and interrogated about resistance activity in the Gaza Strip. They said they were sat in chairs for 6 hours and then brought back to the chair 3 or 4 hours at a time. They didn't know if it was night or day. There were clear suggestions that torture was applied. Mahmoud Abu Saeed, the 19-year-old who was used as a human shield, was also abducted and held in prison. When I interviewed him, he was so traumatized that he collapsed several times into a chair, and we had to revive him with water. He shook as he spoke. He said, "I feel weak. I'm not myself anymore." This is a kind of psychological torture that we witnessed exacted on this young man. And you heard Mohammed Omer's testimony of the violence in Khuza and the abductions. When I met Hani Najjar, he told me that at least 13 members of his family were still in Israeli prisons. The invasions of Shuja'iyah and Rafah had already exacted a devastating toll on the residents when they were initiated, but the death tolls and the levels of destruction spiked dramatically when Israeli forces invoked a semi-secret policy known as the Hannibal Directive. You know, in the U.S., we prefer like Orwellian terms for horrible policies like the Clear Skies Initiative, but in Israel there's no compunction about naming a policy after Hannibal Lecter. In fact, this policy is named after the Carthaginian general who chose to poison himself rather than be held captive by the enemy. And that explains what it is. It was established in 1986 following the Jibril Agreement, a prisoner exchange in which Israel traded 1,150 Palestinian prisoners for 3 Israeli soldiers. There was a huge political backlash, and the Israeli military drafted this secret field procedure to prevent future kidnappings. It was designed not only to eliminate the soldiers' captors, but possibly the soldier himself. In Shuja'iyah and Rafah, the Hannibal Directive was applied not only to deliberately kill 2 Israeli soldiers, depriving their parents of the opportunity to agitate for their release in a politically controversial prisoner swap, and providing us with a very strong commentary on the extent to which Israel values the life of its own citizens. But as an ostensible mechanism for revenge on the entire civilian population, in Shuja'iyah, the capture of Sergeant Shaul Oron of the Golani Brigades following an attack on an armored personnel carrier triggered the attack on Shuja'iyah that left the neighborhood devastated. This was the result of the invocation of the Hannibal Directive. In Rafah, the Hannibal Directive was invoked after the capture by a Qassam Brigade's ambush team a half hour before a humanitarian ceasefire was to begin, of Lieutenant Hadar Golden, who had led a unit of the Givati Brigade's elite paratrooper unit 101 in occupying a civilian home, which would have been a violation of the ceasefire agreement. This was the day that residents of Rafah know as Black Friday. As soon as the phrase Hannibal blared across Israeli army radios, the Israeli military bombarded Rafah with almost every mode of destruction available to it, from F-16 missiles to Apache rockets, to naval shelling, to drone strikes, to a rain of mortar shells. Bulldozers ripped down homes near the area where the capture of Golden took place, while tanks barreled through neighborhoods, shelling anything in sight. In a matter of hours, at least 500 artillery shells and hundreds of missiles were dumped on the city, almost entirely in civilian areas. By the end, at least 190 people had been killed, including Golden, apparently, which was the objective, though his condition was unclear at the time of his capture. When the Israeli military threatened to bomb Rafah's Najjar Hospital, hundreds of dead and wounded were forced to evacuate to Kuwaiti Hospital, a tiny dental and OBGYN clinic with 20 beds, where Dr. Samir Al-Homs told me he was forced to carry out amputations and operations in the hallways and the floors of the hospital to store body parts and dead bodies, including children, in ice cream coolers and meat lockers. Colonel Ofer Winter was the commander of the Givati brigades that presided over the massacres in Hosa and Rafah. And Winter is a significant figure for the jury's consideration, not only because he admitted openly to invoking the Hannibal directive to kill Golden in an August 15th Yediot Aronot interview, but because of the sensibility he embodies and expressed going into battle. Winter is a graduate of B'nai David, a pre-army yeshiva that has played a central role in filling the ranks of the military's officer corps with religious nationalists, I'm wrapping up now, committed to a messianic perspective on society and combat. He's one of the religious Zionists who now comprise at least 40% of the Israeli military's officer corps. He views Palestinians not necessarily as a population that's hostile to Israel or as enemy combatants, but as blasphemers against God. In a letter he issued to his troops prior to the ground invasion of Gaza in Operation Cast Lead, Winter declared, "History has chosen us to be the sharp edge of the bayonet of fighting the terrorist enemy from Gaza, which curses, defames, and abuses the God of Israel's battles." They are blasphemers, not enemy combatants. This is a standard view among the religious nationalists who increasingly populate the ranks of the Israeli Army Officer Corps and who dictated the course of events to an unprecedented degree across the Gaza Strip. In his August 15th interview with Yediot Aronot, Winter took a victory lap here as one of the most popular figures in Israeli society, someone who is stopped on the street routinely for photo ops. He evinced what, in my opinion, was a genocidal philosophy, describing the entire civilian population of the Gaza Strip as the target, the explicit target of the troops under his command. I quote, "In almost every home there is a son or other relative that is a partner in terror," Winter declared. "How do you raise children in a home with explosives?" he asked. "In the end, everyone gets what they choose." He added, "We shredded them." Just in closing, I want to make two points. These crimes that I described, which demonstrate a clear pattern and show that there are stated policies which make them all, at least if not possible, then necessary, they have to be analyzed in a broader context, not just in the context of Operation Cast Lead. They have to be analyzed in the context of over one century of colonization, of settler colonialism according to the philosophy of Zionism. They have to be analyzed according to the Israeli policy of warehousing the entire population of the Gaza Strip, 80% of whom are refugees, treating them as surplus humanity because they are not Jews. They must be kept there perpetually in order to preserve the ethnic purity of the Jewish state. And so these crimes and everything you're hearing about goes to the heart of the logic of the Jewish state and the natural imperatives of Zionism. We have to answer the question, address the question of genocide in not that context, in the entire context of Israel-Palestine, including Palestinian refugees and why they're kept out. Finally, I want to make one last point, which is that we've heard all day about Palestinians in the Gaza Strip as victims, as people who suffer, and it's true, they've suffered enormously. It's true that they're victims, but they're also people who resist. The word mukawama is not used lightly, the word which means resistance. The word sumud, which sums up, which really embodies Palestinian culture and means steadfastness, is not used lightly. These are people who resist. These are strong people, and you can resist too, and you should resist too. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very powerful presentation. Let me ask the first question. question. You definitely present a pattern that establishes a overall intent to impose collective punishment on the population of Palestine. And you also, your ending, you broadened the historical context to suggest that one has to think of the whole Zionist project as part of one's understanding of these specific crimes. But I wonder how you would characterize protective edge as a whole. Does that by itself provide the foundation for an inference of genocide?
I don't have the legal background to come to an explicit conclusion on the question of genocide in this operation, unlike you. I do think that given the conduct of Colonel Ofer Winter and his stated opinions, given the incitement to genocide that David Sheen so clearly documented, given the demonstration of dehumanization in which Palestinians are viewed as unpeople, which was played out in this operation, we have to at least conclude that there were genocidal aspects to it. I do believe, based on my work inside Israeli society, which I encapsulated in my book, Goliath, that Jewish-Israeli society is primed for genocide. Thanks to the special relationship with the United States, it has the capacity for genocide. But I'm unable to come to any conclusion on whether it has committed the crime of genocide based on my limited background in international law.
Quick supplemental question to that. If we wish to seek the sources, in other words, where will we find reported the opinions of the colonel who you've mentioned? Because obviously we need to be careful about what he said.
The letter that Colonel Ofer Winter delivered to his troops was reported in Ma'ariv, which is a major Israeli newspaper, and the interview that he gave on August 15th to Yediot Aronot was translated and reprinted in Electronic Intifada. In fact, both documents appeared in Electronic Intifada, which is one of the most important news and opinion outlets on the issue of on the subject of Israel-Palestine, and really does suggest a way forward for our media and doesn't cater to the false narrative of both sides.
Other?
Yes, thank you. Thanks very much, and I think you've helped us immensely.
Thank you.
And particularly in terms of your approach that the entire period of Zionism should be looked at. So one needs to see that whole historic context. Within that, I'm just going to ask you, you see, as we see the whole history of Zionism and then Israel to the point today where the treatment, the criminality has become so much more savage. But from the time of Theodor Herzl, right at the beginning, the whole approach is about the ethnic cleansing of the non-people. And then we see, particularly from 47, 48 and so on, the Deir Yassin massacres, the kind of statements made then about the right to get rid of the Palestinians, to kill men, women and children, etc. Sharon and his ilk back in the 50s, the way they behaved. So following through on that, you've pointed out that the military now have many more religious nationalists within their ranks. In a sense, although there's much more excessive language, the massacres and the treatment are the same. From that point of view,
one actually sees that the entire thread of Zionism and the creation of the State of Israel has needed ethnic cleansing, has needed the settler racism and hatred, and in fact gets to the point that we're particularly looking at, and that's the possibility that it's a genocidal, or as Ilan Pappe says, incremental genocide. It's a comment, but it's also an attempt to inquire into your way of thinking and the context you put it in. Thanks.
Let me make a few points based on your comments. It's important to note that what we now know of as the Zionist left, the kibbutz movement, that's embodied in the more now kind of moribund Labor Party, is responsible for the bulk of violence throughout the history of the Israel-Palestine crisis or conquest. I don't call it a conflict. Just consider Martin Lejeune's presentation of destroyed factories, a deliberate attempt to destroy the Palestinian economy in the Gaza Strip, and compare that to what happened in Mandate Palestine under the influence of David Ben-Gurion, who is the head of the Zionist labor union, Histadrut. The practice of kibush ha'avodah, or the conquest of labor, in which Zionist movement attempted to create Jews-only businesses, including through boycotting Arab labor, Arab businesses, and attacking Jews who would employ Palestinians. This was the first attempt to destroy the Palestinian economy as a pretext for the ethnic cleansing that later occurred in 1947 and 1948. In 1967, that was the beginning of the passing of the torch from the kibbutz movement, the Zionist left, to the settlers, the figures who, you know, gave rise to people like Colonel Ofer Winter. I mean, he saw that with Yigal Alon, who carried out Plan Dalit and the ethnic cleansing in 1948, coming to Hebron to remove Rabbi Moshe Levinger, who had begun to establish a settlement there right after the occupation, and then shaking his hand and thanking him because he reminded him of the original so-called Zionist pioneers. So you see the transfer there. The religious nationalists, the settlement movement, had the dynamism and the energy and the lack of moral compunction to continue this colonial project as it expanded into the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And that's why they have emerged increasingly as the captains of the state. They view the secular state as an ass or a donkey that they have to ride towards dominion. And that necessitated strategies of infiltration of the key institutions of the state. And what's the most important institution? It's the army. That's why they're taking over the army, and they just simply have less moral compunctions about what needs to be done to perpetuate a settler colonial project in which demographic engineering, the maintenance of 70% demographic advantage over Palestinians and territory controlled by Israel, is necessary. It's a dirty business, and these are the figures who are going to do it, and they have a holy, divine mission. And I do believe that it has increased the violence on the ground, and that one of these figures will become the next prime minister, probably Naftali Bennett of the Jewish Home Party, who is the big winner of this war, and is slated to gain at least 5 seats if elections were held today, not just on Netanyahu's Likud party, but also on the centrist Yesh Atid party. So this war drove the collapse of the so-called Israeli political center. You know, Iran talked about it's going to happen again. Well, we have to look at the politics of Israel to understand how that's possible, as well as the military aspect.
Thank you very much for a most illuminating presentation.
And this concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a weekly segment here on WZBC Newton 90.3 FM. And it's part of Truth and Justice Radio, heard every Sunday morning from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope that you'll join us again for news and views from and about Palestine.